You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of April 2017 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme,
we're also meeting with the Prime Minister of Canada, and we will be meeting with the President of Mexico, who I know, and we're going to start some negotiations having to do with NAFTA.
US President Donald Trump backs down from his promise to scrap the North American Free Trade Agreement, but what would the ideal deal he says he wants actually look like? We'll also be examining whether the UK needs parliamentary approval to join any future military strikes in Syria, and we'll ask if Venezuela is avoiding international scrutiny by withdrawing from the Organization of American States. And
now you have decided to close down a university. And my request to you is, how far will you go?
The EU takes legal action against Hungary's Viktor Orban over its attacks on a prestigious university. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Samira Shackle, a journalist specialising in social affairs, politics and South Asia, and Michael Goldfarb, veteran journalist and broadcaster. Welcome to you both. We begin with a look at Syria following today's remarks by the UK's Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, who said it would be difficult to refuse the US if asked to support another military strike in the region. Now, Michael Goldfarb, we should be clear that there isn't any talk of another military strike in the region at the moment. This was a question that he was asked during the course of the election campaign that's happening here in the UK at the moment. But there was something a little bit odd about this comment, wasn't there? Because he was essentially saying not that, in his view, Britain should take military action in Syria, but that if America decides to, Britain would probably join them.
I think at one level, it seems to me fuss over nothing. I mean, I doubt very much that any British administration would ever think other than if it received a call in the middle of the night from the White House saying, look, we're doing this. Are you, one, can you help? Two, will you back? In that order, I think, probably. Anyway, but you know, there's a new precedent been set, and it's been set on Syria. And we all remember that in 2013, when Assad was first accused of using sarin gas against his own people, that was the red line. And Obama was going to now intervene militarily at some level. And David Cameron said, I need to go to Parliament and get Parliament's approval. Well, Parliament didn't approve. And 2 days later, 3 days later, Obama walked away from his red line, in part because if your oldest ally isn't going to come along with you, why are you going to do this? He didn't want to be out on a limb. So in that respect, that's what makes it odd, because you would think that this is the precedent. On the other hand, you know, with the new American administration, you know, they can decide willy-nilly to have another round of tomahawks for whatever reason, and Parliament is no longer in session because there's an election on.
But there are two issues here, Samir, aren't there? Because one is, as Michael's saying, about whether the UK Parliament will have a say in whether the UK takes any military action in this hypothetical case. But then there's the other aspect of this, which is Boris Johnson saying, we'll do what the Americans want.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be inclined to agree that's sort of what most British administrations have probably thought for quite a long time, that they'll largely follow the US example on, or sort of follow the US lead, as it were, on military action. We've seen that notoriously in lots of cases over the last few decades. I think there's also, you kind of can't really separate it from the domestic political situation where, you know, Britain's standing in the world is much diminished already and set to be diminished further by exiting the EU. There's quite conscious effort to sort of reassert that relationship with the US, probably even more kind of desperately than it's been done by some past leaders. You know, that kind of special relationship is a sort of almost neediness about asserting that, I think, particularly when faced with exiting a large block of nations. So I think I don't think it's necessarily a surprise that that's what Johnson, and I think he said that Theresa May shared his view. I don't think it's really should be really a surprise that that's what they think and that's what they would do. It's, I guess, unusual to hear it put in those terms.
And that's perhaps the thing, isn't it, Michael, that it was that this view was voiced that, well, if the Americans want to do this, then yes, we'll strike Syria. But if America doesn't want to, we won't strike Syria.
Well, I mean, it's also I don't know. I mean, we speak of an alliance and, you know, but there's clearly a senior partner. I think that, you know, now that the UK is leaving the European Union, it will doubtless be even more inclined to join in American military adventures. But having said that, you know, I mean, the EU doesn't have a common defense policy and it doesn't have a common foreign policy. That's always been the fudge there because neither France nor Britain wanted to cede control of their foreign and defense policies. And for that matter, neither did Germany. And they're the big boys. You know, they work commonly in NATO and that's where that's set aside for. I don't know. This is also, I think, an election story. I think that Boris Johnson, for the previous 48 hours, people were wondering, where is Boris Johnson, the most colorful figure, some would say idiotic figure, in British public life? And he hadn't been out front since the election was called. And so he's now, you know, weighed in. And I think there's probably several platoons of reporters whose livelihoods depend on Boris making news. And so they're making news out of this statement.
We've been talking about this for 5 minutes or so, and we've managed to talk just about the actual issue in Syria. But if you had been listening to the radio here in the UK earlier today and talking about Boris Johnson, they weren't talking about Syria. They were talking about the fact that he used some strange word, mugwump, to describe Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the opposition. Now, we're going to... In fact, tell you what, first of all, Michael, you know what this weird word means. Explain and also why Boris Johnson has got it wrong, whatever he was trying to say.
All right.
Before we get onto the substance of what all this means.
Okay. The mugwumps were Republicans. 20 years after the Civil War, they were very right-wing Republicans. Remember, the Republican Party was the party of Lincoln and quite a progressive party in the 19th century. Anyway, in the election of 86, it could be 82, Grover Cleveland, was the Democratic nominee, and he was quite right-wing and protectionist and all the other stuff. And they said, well, we are going to support the Democratic candidate. So basically, they were party splitters. And it's odd because, of course, Jeremy Corbyn is a perfect example of, you know, he's been in the Labour Party all his life, but he's never done what the leaders of the Labour Party have asked him. He is kind of, I guess, a mugwump without leaving the party. But the other funny thing, of course, is that he assaults him for being some Islingtonian, you know, out-of-touch elite. And, of course, Boris lives in Islington, and Jeremy Corbyn is his constituency MP.
Samira, the fact, though, that so many British political journalists are getting excited about the fact that Boris said something funny, as someone was pointing out earlier today, can anyone think of an example recently where Boris saying something funny led us into a difficult situation? Journalists don't take him seriously, do they? They see him as a figure of fun and let him say what he wants.
Yeah, definitely. And it's quite they do. It's quite tedious, really, that he sort of hides behind this this sort of buffoonish exterior and quite enjoys saying outrageous things. At least this, for once, wasn't quite tacitly or openly racist, as far as I'm aware. And unlike the large proportion of the hilarious comments he makes, it's hilarious strictly in inverted commas. But I think also, I mean, as you say, it does allow him to sort of get away with a lot. So in the same interview, pulled up on the leaving the EU will allow £350 million a week to be spent on the NHS, which was notoriously printed on a bus and was a complete fabrication and has been widely accepted to be a complete fabrication. He sort of in the same interview was saying, no, that could be true. And it just sort of slides by because he also just used a stupid word.
Okay, so let's move from one politician with an interesting approach to the truth to another. US President Donald Trump has backed away from his promise to scrap NAFTA, that's the North American Free Trade Agreement. He admitted to having made the decision after calls from the leaders of Canada and Mexico after they asked him to renegotiate it rather than terminate it. Michael Goldfarb, the footage of him in the West Wing, in the Oval Office, talking about this, where he says, I was going to scrap it a couple of days ago, but then I spoke to them and I like them and they asked me to renegotiate it, so I'll renegotiate it. I mean, it's been 100 days, it feels like 100 years, but, you know, even this makes me speechless.
This is radio and nobody could see your face as you were asking me that question. Listeners, the man was contorted with a deep, soulful pain that he lived in such times. Yeah, you know, but the interesting thing about this is that in his position throughout the campaign, and even when he was in the primaries campaigning for the nomination of the Republican Party, was, we will renegotiate NAFTA. That was it. And he said, these are all terrible deals. I'm going to renegotiate them. And then he laid out his Trump card, as it were, and said, and if I don't like the deal that we agree, I will walk from these things. So in a sense, he's one of the rare occasions in these first 100 days where he is absolutely fulfilling a campaign pledge. But the way they haven't been dealing, I don't think that there's any master plan. I think that the right hand has no idea what the left hand is doing in the West Wing. And some people got out front of the story and said, we're leaving NAFTA, the anti-free trade group. That's how they briefed the press. The president himself, I think, said something to that effect. And then suddenly it's back to, no, we're just going to renegotiate the deal.
But it's interesting as well, Michael, the way that he talks about it, as in like, I spoke to these guys and they said I shouldn't. So, you know, it's one thing to be known as someone who makes decisions based on what the last person they spoke to said to them. Mm. But it's quite another thing to say that essentially out loud.
Yeah. But the thing is that, I mean, I've just come back. I was there in America 2 weeks ago, and I've been reporting on the 100 days and focused specifically on Trump supporters that I've met over the last 18 months. And, you know, that's priced in to their expectations of him. And although his approval ratings are at a historic low for any president in this honeymoon period, the core group that he needs to rely on, his voters, kind of expect this of him. And while you and I might grimace thinking and talking about it, they, on the other hand, say, well, that's who he is. We knew that going in.
I'm going to come back to you on that in a moment. But first, Samira, when you... Let's look at this as if he were a normal president. You know, he promised to repeal and replace healthcare. Obamacare hasn't done that. He's promised to build a wall and Mexico pay for it. Now it's not entirely clear if there will be a wall, who will pay for it, whether the wall was actually metaphorical in the first place. He has made various... He said that China was a currency manipulator pretty much every day. Now he says, no, China's not a currency manipulator. Do you think any of these complete 180-degree reversals matter?
Well, I think they do. I mean, he's got, I think, record sort of plunge in his approval ratings. I don't think it's unprecedented how much his approval ratings have dipped within the first 100 days, even among his sort of support base. But I think we're seeing in his kind of response to being pulled up on these things, I don't know if you read, there's quite a astonishing transcript of an interview with the Associated Press that they published. And I mean, a lot of it's basically word salad. It's quite hard to read, but there's, he's sort of pulled up on this question of the first 100 days and the fact that he hasn't really stuck to any of his promises. And he's basically says, well, no, I have. She sort of lists all the ways he hasn't. He said, do you think you should be held to account on that? And he's just sort of completely avoids the question, sort of just, he's quite happy to say two completely contradictory things in the same breath, and it makes it quite challenging to pull someone up on things if they're A, not bound by the truth in any way, and B, sort of completely unashamed of being faced with said facts that they're disregarding. And that's the same thing you saw on the campaign trail. I would hope that it will catch up with him, if nothing else, with sort of causing disquiet among his supporter base and among his own party. But yeah, it's a sort of complete disregard for the very concept of being held to account makes it harder to hold someone to account, I think.
One of the other things Michael was striking in that interview was he talks about how the reason why he said NATO was obsolete was because essentially he didn't know much about NATO. He says, I was doing real estate deals in Manhattan. We don't talk about NATO much there. I was asked about it. I said, oh, NATO is obsolete. You know, he's also said, China needs to sort out North Korea, and then says, you know what? I actually spoke to President Xi for 10 minutes and he explained the relationship between China and North Korea. It's a lot more complicated than you thought. Yeah. Healthcare, again, he has said, yeah. Who knew?
Just hang on, it's actually quite difficult.
It's actually quite complicated,
isn't
it?
He said that about quite a few things, that it just seemed to be completely astounded that the work of governing is quite complicated.
And Mike, I want to come back to your point about Trump supporters. Like, we keep on hearing this. It's like, you people with your facts, you think this matters, but actually you talk to Trump supporters and they don't care. They took him seriously, but not literally. But as Samira points out, his approval ratings are astonishingly low. They're in the 30s. So yes, Trump supporters might support him, but there are fewer Trump supporters now than there were 3 months ago.
I don't know if that's true. I mean, I think that roughly it was, you would have put it at about 40% of the electorate.
He got 45 to 46%.
Yeah, I mean, but I'm
vote,
saying that, but
his approval ratings are in the 30s. So,
no, but what I'm saying is, if you take he got 45% of the vote, but the electorate age, it was about 40%. A lot of people didn't bother to turn up, as always, and that's down to about 36. And it holds. What's interesting, I think, that if people who really want to see, who are interested in data, is the Washington Post had an absolutely spot on poll, which ran on Sunday, and you can find it online easily enough just by going to the Washington Post website or Googling Washington Post Trump first 100 days opinion poll, and it will turn up. And it drills a lot deeper than the simple number of 35-36% approval rating. And once you get into the more specific segments of the population, and I'm just saying what I found, anecdotally, which is, in the parts of the country that really support him, meaning the South and the Midwest, they're not fussed. I think that what we haven't spoken about, and he didn't get it done in 100 days, the tax-cutting plan that he announced yesterday is ultimately what Americans who support him care about. The small businessmen who may, if you sit with them and have a beer, they'll say, yeah, he is a bit of an embarrassment, but we don't care, because he's going to cut business rates to 15%, or says he will. Now he's working on a simplified tax code. Taxes are their core issue. They don't care about the rest of the world, and they don't even care how the rest of the world sees the United States, because Donald Trump is now the president.
Samira, there's the other thing that we need to factor in here, which is that sometimes all of us perhaps underestimate how difficult it is for someone to change their mind. I mean, I'm sure everyone around this table has views that they strongly believe in. And, seeing a couple of facts or a news story or hearing a politician say something won't necessarily shake you of that belief that this person is right or this policy is right. Do you think that there is too much emphasis on, well, look at the facts and, look what's happening. Surely you must understand that this guy's a nightmare.
I think it's a really complicated picture, isn't it? I guess there's the whole idea of, we're incredibly, the sort of media landscape allows us to be incredibly selective about what facts we take in at all, which there's already all sorts of studies of the human human capacity for reason or whatever, human psychology, that shows that we all have a tendency towards confirmation bias. And I think the way that we consume information and news nowadays, sort of really, you know, we've had a lot of talk about this over the last year or so, allows us to consume news in those bubbles where you're not even having to disregard facts you don't agree with, you simply don't see them. So I think that I think that's certainly true, sort of on top of that existing psychological trait that we have as human beings to sort of give more precedence to facts which confirm our existing biases. I think lots of people in, say, Trump's core constituency are simply not going to be reading a sort of New York Times expose or Washington Post piece that reveals XYZ. So, yeah, so it's definitely a problem.
Okay, let's take a quick break. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're back after this.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto and New York City. In Toronto, our bureau chief is Thomas Lewis.
Torontonians like to think of this place as one of the most diverse and one of the most tolerant anywhere in Canada, if not anywhere in the world. And the energy that brings off, I think, is really fertile ground for a journalist, a bureau chief, for Monocle as a whole to tap into and to play a key part in.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
And you are back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me here in Studio One, Michael Goldfarb and Samira Shackle. Venezuela has announced that it will withdraw from the Organization of American States, accusing the group of meddling in its internal affairs. Several neighboring nations have expressed their concerns over the past months over the ongoing crisis in the country. Samira, Venezuela has tried to rely on fellow left-wing allies within the region for regional support, and it still arguably has some in Ecuador, and in Bolivia, perhaps also in Cuba if we're going that far north. But it does still want to be part of, you know, the broader region, doesn't it? And it's, and having this level of criticism from its from other nations, whether that's Colombia, Uruguay, Brazil, Argentina, does have an impact.
Yeah, definitely. I think the fighting talk from the foreign minister today about exiting this Organization of American States, talking about the sort of criticisms that have been levelled against Venezuela by this country bloc, talking about that as in seeking to interfere in the country's internal affairs and sort of speaking about it almost as if it's a sort of coup or attempt at regime change or whatever. It shows a sensitivity, I think. And actually, you know, a lot of states, I think, do have a level of desire for international acceptability. You see it kind of across the board. It's not, I think that the majority of states probably don't want to sort of be ostracised in the international community because that has all sorts of knock-on effects. And so I don't think it's surprising in that respect. But yeah, I think certainly the level of criticism they're coming under is obviously starting to have an effect.
And Michael, do you think that in the long term, Nicolás Maduro necessarily cares whether he's being criticised by regional allies?
No, I mean, it's odd. What's going on in Venezuela, just before we came on the air, or we came into the studio, I was checking some social media. I did some reporting from Venezuela a decade ago, and I've stayed in touch with people I met there. And the situation is really quite dire. And someone had put up essentially a leaflet, but is on their wall. They want the international press to start paying attention. You know, when Hugo Chavez was running the country, Venezuela was on the front page a lot. But Maduro has been consolidating his control and turning it into an old-fashioned dictatorship. It's moved beyond traditional Latin American caudillo. How would we say it in Spanish? I don't really speak Spanish. Caudillerista. the old-fashioned Caudillo, he's beyond that. I mean, he's going to be a proper dictator, and possibly not even, you know, I mean, Fidel is gone. Those days are over. And I don't think he cares. I really don't. There's still, there should be a space for left-wing, even if not leading their countries, for left-wing leading politicians to go to Venezuela and say, look, you can't do this. Look at what you're doing to your people. And we've had the most extraordinary demonstrations. I mean, probably everyone listening to this will have seen pictures out of context on social media of these massive marches on the highways, which usually are completely jammed with cars and other jammed with people. And yet nothing is shaking Maduro. And if your own people can't shake Maduro, then these kinds of international organizations certainly can't shake Maduro.
Okay, let's move from one strong man and his relationship with an international organisation to another. Finally on today's programme, Hungary's Viktor Orban versus the European Union. Let's hear a bit first of what Guy Verhofstadt, a MP in the European Parliament, had to say about Orban yesterday.
A lot changed since 1990 and since 1989 when we saw each other. You changed. You dumped your democratic principles. And in a certain way, you don't, yeah, you say it openly. I want to create not a liberal democracy, but I want to go to an illiberal state. And the list is long for the moment. What you have done, harassing NGOs, chasing away critical media, building walls, your attempt also, your opinion to reinstate a death penalty in your country, even when it is not possible based on our treaties. And now you have decided to close down a university. And my request to you is, how far will you go?
Samira, at last the EU seems to be actually taking notice of what's happening in Hungary.
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting, leading on from the, you know, Venezuela, we were just talking about one strong man choosing to exit an international bloc. And you've had Hungary, Orbán said when asked if Hungary would follow the UK and leaving the EU, he's basically said, no, I don't have any interest in that. And you kind of see that here that there can be consequences to failing to adhere to those kinds of treaties and rules that you agree to abide by when you enter a bloc like the European Union. Of course, I think with the sort of concrete proposals that, you know, that I think they're taking legal action specifically over this attempt to shut down this university through these sort of laws about foreign ownership, foreign registration of universities. There's a quite substantial chance, I think, that those legal processes are going to be too slow to actually save that university. And as far as I'm aware, there isn't sort of legal action on things like the sort of failing to meet asylum quotas and sort of abusive human rights, arguably on the border and so on. So I don't know if that rhetoric has been matched by action yet, but it's certainly good to see at least some notice being taken in a formal way of sort of real slide to authoritarianism.
This is something, Michael, yeah, the European Union didn't ever think it would have to deal with. It was a community and then a union of democracies that all on the whole thought the same way. And then we had the situation in 1990-2000 with Jörg Haider and the Freedom Party in Austria, a far-right party that became part of the government, and the EU suspended Austria. It then let Austria back in. And who knows whether they would have suspended them this time around if Norbert Hofer had become president. That's perhaps another issue. But since the accession to the East, the European Union has had to grapple with the fact that it has some members that aren't the, you know, all singing, all dancing liberal democracies of France, Germany, and others that they hoped the club would always remain.
Yeah, the broad question, of course, is Poland also is slipping towards an authoritarian style of government, and yet the president of the commission is Donald Tusk, who's Polish, and
from a very different wing of Poland.
Of Polish politics, and he's quite an effective European-wide politician. So, I mean, I suppose so long as there's real democracy in place, they can't just be suspending. I mean, the interesting story here is that you heard Guy Verhofstadt talk about 1989-1990, and this was when they met, this was under the auspices of George Soros, who set up Central European University and who talent-tapped Viktor Orban as someone who could be a potential political leader of the future. And now, of course, Orban thinks that Soros is his university has to be shut down. I don't know. I think they have to ride it out. There are no, I don't think there's anything that they can do much beyond that except ride it out.
Okay, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Michael Goldfarb, Samira Shackle, thank you both very much indeed. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Carlos Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Helena Jarit. The studio manager was George McDonough. At 1900, so that's in about half an hour. It's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck, and we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200. Midori House back same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London, 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.